Rich Roll is a dad, athlete, and author of Finding Ultra. He also hosts the long-running, super interesting, and widely popular Rich Roll podcast. We talked about existential crises, alcoholism and ambition, the value of solitude, dating my sister, wisdom, and what art is. Thanks so much for agreeing to talk to me.
I'm so happy that you reached out to me, Heidi. It's absolutely a delight to see you. It's been many years. So I've been looking forward to this for a very long time. So thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I was thinking on the way here about how I ended up coming here today. And on one level, yeah, maybe it goes back 25 years. But most recently, I think I told you I agreed to have Rand Stegen be my coach for a talk. And The first night I met him, he sat down and he said, "Oh, I just came from this amazing conference. The keynote speaker was so inspiring. He's an ultra marathoner. He's, you know, a vegan. It's a guy named Rich Roll." And I was like, "What?" I was like, "Right. Rich Roll? Wait, seriously?
That drunk guy that used to date my sister? Can't be the same guy."
So where do you think you were that he heard you? Do you know?
I don't know. I mean, I've spoken at a lot of conferences, so yeah. I can't say which. I mean, where does he live? Like, what do you know? What conference he was at?
Well, he's in Dallas, but this was about 18 months ago. But maybe it's more of a question of when you are a keynote speaker, what kind of things do you talk about? What do you think he would have been inspired by?
My keynote is sort of constructed in the way a very good AA pitch is constructed, okay, which is what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So basically, I tell my story, and I use my story to try to empower and motivate and inspire people. And I go on tangents about certain aspects of my story that lend themselves towards a broader discussion about issues that I care about, whether it's the environment or health and diet and things of that nature. But it's basically kind of, you know, how I went from the guy that you used to know into, mm-hmm, you know, a person who, you know, in a very surreal way now finds himself up on stages telling stories to begin with, which is all very strange.
So when you said the drunk guy that used to date your sister, you know, some people may think that that was a joke, but that actually, you did date my sister. That
I
is
did.
How we know each other.
Yeah.
So, and I guess I was part of your life in a way a long time ago. And I know your story from having, you know, been part of it, but then not, you know, for a long time. Mm-hmm. So maybe we do start talking about it from there. So you were living in New York, mm-hmm, when we knew each other, and you were going to be a lawyer.
I was.
You were a lawyer.
I don't know what was going on in my mind, because at that time I was working in a law firm as a paralegal. I worked at this big Wall Street law firm called Skadden Arps.
Right.
It was kind of in the midst of the M&A heyday, and that was kind of like the place where all the deal flow was. So in one respect, it was kind of exciting to be in the middle of all of that. But, you know, I couldn't have been lower on the, you know, pecking order. And there was a lot of yelling and a lot of, you know, unable, sort of inability to plan your life, like working crazy hours for no money, in a job that had no upward mobility, you know. And I saw enough to realize, like, this is not the career path for me. But for some reason, I still ended up going to law school. But I loved my time living in New York. It was right after college. I'd never lived in a place that was so cosmopolitan and dynamic, and it opened up a whole world of creativity to me that kind of percolated in the back of my consciousness for a long time. And meeting your sister and spending time with her was a big part of that. Like, I was introduced to, you know, going and visiting film sets and going to theater. And like, she introduced me to Darren Aronofsky, and like, it was, you know, right. It was a really cool, fun period. And she was like my cipher into that. And I think that, you know, that's always stayed with me. And I have such great fondness for Laura and that time, and your family. I mean, your mom and Gary and everybody, your brother, were always like super kind and welcoming to me.
So interesting. You know, when I think about that time in New York too, and Laura, she was an actress and then she shifted over to working in the film business. But, you know, we joke about some of those like terrible plays that she was in that were in the meatpacking district.
Yeah. And like site-specific plays where they would take over in an abandoned building. And I was like, what is happening here?
And, you know, for me, that was... I don't know if it was normal, but, you know, I was already in the art world. And so there's a correlation between that kind of, you know, very fringe theater and, you know, performance art. But there were things that were really unusual, even, you know, for my experiences. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was just in it, like full in, you know, running down streets and, you know, and you had at that time, like a very, I think, traditional conservative, yes, Stanford, you know, athlete, it was different.
I was the product of a very traditional upbringing. My parents, you know, I grew up in an inside the Beltway family. My dad was a government lawyer at the FTC, and then he went into private practice. And my mom was a teacher to learning disabled kids. And we grew up middle class and then upper middle class once he started making money. And I went to a very Tony private school called the Landon School for Boys, where you wear a coat and tie every day. And your classmates are, you know, the sons of senators and congressmen. So there's a lot of, you know, lacrosse, and, you know, it was that kind of a thing, right? And I was always a very kind of quiet, shy, unassuming, insecure kind of kid. I wasn't, you know, playing lacrosse and football and the like. I was more likely to be found in the corner reading a book, very much to myself. And I struggled socially, but I kind of found my groove in swimming, which was the one physical discipline that I had like any kind of natural talent for. And I put myself into that world and realized like this is my way forward and my way out. I don't know what I felt like I needed to escape from, but there was definitely a sense inside of me that I need to do something different, and this is going to allow me to have broader choices in my life. So by the time I was a senior in high school, I was one of the top swimmers on the Eastern Seaboard. I was getting recruited to all of these schools, and I began to excel academically. I graduated top of my class, and so I got into all the fancy schools. I ended up going to Stanford, which, in addition to being this, you know, extraordinary academic institution, also happened to have by far the best collegiate swim team in the country at that point. So I had this opportunity to go train alongside Olympic gold medalists and world record holders, and it was like a dream come true. But that's when I got introduced to alcohol, and that quickly shifted my priorities. And I wouldn't say that I was struck with alcoholism overnight. It's a very progressive disease, but it started to kind of erode my ambitions and what I cared about, to the point that, you know, I really didn't swim fast ever again. I didn't really care about my grades. I wasn't thinking about what I wanted to do with my life. And so when I graduated from college, I remember very distinctly thinking, I'm going to go to New York City because I can drink there and I don't have to drive and I'm not going to get a DUI. That was like a part of my mental calculus. And sure enough, I arrive in New York City. The job was just an excuse to be in this incredible city. And I made, you know, as much of it as I could on the few dollars that I made. And I had an incredible time socially. Like, alcohol cured all of that insecurity and that social anxiety that I had. And, you know, I was making tons of friends and, you know, all over the city and all of that. And I met your sister, and like we discussed, like, she opened up this crazy world to me. And being this kind of waspy product of private education, she was somebody, she was like nobody I'd ever met before, because she had this childlike quality, like just so open and like fun and like adventurous and like, let's go do this. And I'm going to do this crazy play. And we're going to, like, there was nothing that was off the table. And I just was so energized by having that like in my space.
So amazing to hear that feedback about Laura. And I think that's, you know, very, very accurate. Uh-huh. But last night we were out to dinner with my daughter, and then afterwards, you know, I got this feedback that my daughter's like a mini me, right? Uh-huh. And I don't really see that. You know, I really see her as, you know, herself. And of course, you know, she's my daughter. And so I'm focused on, you know, her needs and whatnot. And so it's not dissimilar from my sister and all of the nicknames that, you know, I had for her over time. You know, she was little girl or Mr. Hooper or, you know, like these kind of silly things, right? Where it's a great gift, I think, to have someone who is inclined towards warmth, towards, you know, my sister or my daughter or whatnot, you know, share that feedback of how someone's seen, mm-hmm. right? I think that's a really gracious and generous way to be.
Yeah. I remember you as being, like, you share similarities. My recollection is you shared certain character aspects that Laura has, but you had a very different, like you had a plan. Like you went to Penn and you were going to be in the art world and like you were on a mission.
That's right.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that my plan was super clear, right? Like I was going to work in a museum. I was going to get married. I was going to have a family. Uh-huh. And, you know, I wasn't just going to work in a museum. I was going to be a museum director. And in a very short time, I did all of those things, right? Which is incredible. Yeah. Which is incredible. And interestingly, I didn't have any goals for a really long time because I had all these like super high, difficult to achieve goals and I hit them all, right? And then I didn't really know what I wanted to do for a long time. So, you know, I had sort of the status quo.
It's an existential crisis. I had this author, Mark Manson, on the podcast not too long ago, who's the guy who wrote that book. What's it called? I think it's right behind you. Well, his latest one's called Everything is Fucked. Everything is Fucked, a book about hope.
Is he also the one, The Subtle Art of Not Giving
a
Fuck?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to think of. Yep. Yeah, I don't know why I couldn't think of that. It's because it sold a gajillion copies, right? And
two different people had given me that book.
Yeah. Well, I told him point blank. I was like, when I saw that book popping up everywhere, I was like, this book's bullshit. I'm not reading this book. Like, who's this guy?
I had the same perspective.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
But then you read it. It's actually, you know, it's actually very well done. Like, he did a great job. And it's much more profound and deep and well thought out than you might expect. But to my point of having that kind of existential crisis, like his thing was, I'm gonna be a writer and I'm gonna write books and someday I'll hit the New York Times bestseller list. And he wrote that book and those two books together are like a publishing phenomenon that you only see once in a generation. So here he is at like, I don't know what he was, 31 or something like that, where there's no way he's ever gonna top this ever again. He's making crazy money, just sitting at home playing video games, collecting royalties. Like, what now? You know, what happens to you when you achieve every dream that you've ever set for yourself?
That's right. That is the existential crisis. And it's also the kind of thing that you can't really talk about, right? Because to talk about something like that is to then somehow seem, you know, entitled or ungrateful or exactly. Mm-hmm. So, but it's actually a real thing, right? Because then you have to sit with what it is that you want to do. And for me, I think one of the things that I am grateful for is that I have art. So even though I didn't have any goals per se, I always had this outlet, right? I always had a place that I could go for grounding and balance and inspiration and curiosity. Mm-hmm. So,
and that's never going to change.
And, you know, that's one of the kind of secret goals of this podcast, right? Is to talk to people about what art has meant for them. And even your descriptions of interacting with my sister and those theater productions, which were, you know, really performance art, I mean, that changed your perspective.
Oh, right? It definitely did. It definitely did. And like I said, it still lives with me to this day. I mean, I think there's something about when you're that age too, mm-hmm. like things cement in your consciousness in a different way. But I think about it a lot. And, you know, my existential crisis, you know, took a bit of a different form and came much later in life. Like I, you know, continued to pursue a very traditional career path, like went to law school, you know, got a job at a law firm in San Francisco and then ultimately in Los Angeles. And it was a constant, you know, multi-year process of trying to jam this square peg into a round hole, because unlike you, I wasn't drawn into the law out of some innate passion for mm-hmm. or some, you know, calling to justice or anything like that. I was doing it because I hadn't spent enough time thinking about what it was that I truly wanted to do. And even more than that, I think I was just so profoundly disconnected from my higher self that I was essentially on autopilot, mm-hmm. like just, well, this is what you do and like society will approve this and this is what, you know. So, you know, the alcoholism played itself out until I was 31 and took me to some super dark places. And ultimately, you know, I was able to get sober. I went to a rehab in Oregon when I was 31 in 1998 for 100 days. And that began this journey that I've been on, you know, over the last over 20 years at this point, of attempting to repair that disconnection and connect more profoundly with you know, my most authentic self. And it's something that hasn't happened overnight and continues to, you know, reveal itself to me. But it's been a very slow process of trying to figure out, okay, what is it about me that gets me excited in the morning? What is it that I think I'm here to do? What is it that I can offer that is uniquely me? And that is a spiritual inquest, but it's also a creative pursuit.
Yeah. So how do you answer some of those questions? So the question would be, you know, do you have a personal mission?
Not in a pithy one-liner kind of way, mm-hmm. But I've sort of accidentally found myself in this role and this vocation where I have a platform of people who are interested in what I have to say, and that's something I take seriously. I think there's a responsibility with that, and I'm using it to try to inspire people to go on their version of what I experienced. Ultimately, it's about this journey we're all on towards becoming our most authentic, fully actualized, most expressed selves in whatever form that is. And, you know, I use different vehicles to explore that, whether it's diet and nutrition, fitness, like the endurance things that I've done, or through creativity, artistry, business. You know, they're all different avenues to pursue or explore those same ideas.
So what do you think you care most about?
That's a really good and hard question to answer. I think what I care most about is trying to impact people in the most positive, but also in the most meaningful way that I can. I'm not here to try to build some, you know, the biggest audience possible. Like I'm not doing the podcast so I can get a TV show. It's not about my ego and my, you know, whatever influence. For me, it's about depth rather than breadth. Mm. So when I sit down with somebody for a podcast, or I'm writing on my website, or I'm working on a book, whatever, or I'm getting on a stage to talk to people, or I'm answering an email, I'm always thinking like, what is the thing that I could say in this moment that could perhaps shake something loose in that person and get them to look at something differently, and ultimately, and most importantly, take that and make a change in their life and have that change be sustainable, have it be something that will shift their trajectory and move them in a very different direction that perhaps they hadn't thought of. Because that's been my experience. And I think, you know, when I said, you know, it's been 20 plus years, I mean, this is like, you Google me and it all looks like it happened overnight, you know, but like, this is a very slow process. And I think it's about tiny little shifts over time and little actions taken consistently in order to kind of move somebody's life around.
Yeah. So when you, for me, like when, if I sleep till, you know, 6 or 6:30, I'm good like the whole day. But if I wake up like sometime between like 3:30 and 5:30, that's when I have my moments of like, you know, self-doubt or panic or whatnot. So do you have something like that? If you wake up, not when you're planning to?
I have that regardless of how much I sleep.
Okay.
So, I could have an amazing night of sleep and still wake up with a tremendous amount of self-doubt and panic.
So what still causes that for you with all the things that you've achieved or accomplished, not necessarily outwardly, but inwardly, you know, what still makes you uncomfortable?
I still have a healthy amount of imposter syndrome. I'm still waiting for somebody to take all of this away or to, you know, discover that I'm not worthy. You know, I have a profound insecurity that I have tools to keep at bay, but that's kind of, I have all these default settings, right? Mm-hmm. And what I've learned in sobriety is that those don't necessarily go away, but there is a program of daily maintenance that can keep them at bay and over time help me build, you know, healthier kind of default pathways. But that stuff still is there, you know, and left to my own devices, I will very quickly become, you know, irritable and egocentric and resentful and insecure. And these are all, I think, outward manifestations of fear, and the genesis of that fear being, I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy, or ultimately, I'm going to die, right? Isn't that the ultimate fear behind everything? So I have, you know, a profound capacity for navigating the world from a fear-based perspective. And I do a lot of work to try to not, you know, come from that perspective.
So I've been thinking a lot about this idea, and some years ago I did this program at the Aspen Institute. It was, I can't actually remember what it's called now, but it's basically like kind of a boot camp for CEOs, but it uses traditional texts. So you start with Plato and you read Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, and, you know, you read Hobbes and Locke and, you know, you learn about yourself. And at the end, there's this quadrant. You figure out, you know, where you place yourself. And I was willing to do that, but I needed to come up with my own quadrants, mm-hmm. basically, to figure out where to put myself. And so the vertical trajectory for me was the lowest point was fear, and the highest point on that was transcendence. And, you know, I try and modulate, you know, how far I am from fear, you know, as I get closer to transcendence.
What's the closest you've gotten to transcendence?
I've actually gotten to a place that feels like that twice. Once was with a healer in Aspen named David Hatfield, and he does energetic work, and basically his efforts include a sort of rewriting of your DNA somehow. It changes your origin story. And actually, I had my son do it because I don't know if you know this, but my former husband is an alcoholic. Mm. And so there is that pattern of alcoholism in their bloodline. And so I hope Emerson won't be embarrassed to have me talk about this on the podcast, but he met with David Hatfield to kind of rewrite that patterning. Hopefully. So in a session,
I need to go see this guy.
I'll connect you. Yeah, he is right. Totally amazing. And in a session with him where he was working with me energetically, I felt like I had elevated mentally, almost physically. And I felt like I had a vision of what transcendence looked like or what the divine was. And I felt it in my body.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Probably the single closest time I've been to that.
That's cool. I'm still striving.
Listen, I mean, it's like anything, you know, like art also for me is like an addiction. And, you know, we talk about the aesthetic experience in art where, you know, you're transported from where you are in the moment to mm-hmm. some alternate place. It doesn't change your life, but it feels different for a moment. And I feel like once you have tasted that, then you're chasing it forever.
How strictly do you define what art is and what art isn't?
So I have a really easy answer to that, which is my perspective is something is art if the person who made it intended it to be art. Mm. Period. Full stop. And then people can decide.
It's a circular definition.
Well,
of course.
It's you can decide as a viewer or experiencer of it if it's good or not. So it's not a question of like whether something's good or not. It's just a question as to whether it is art. So for example, a lot of things in museums, I would say, are not art because the person who made them didn't intend them. So for example, these, you know, bowls, right? Like pre-modern bowls. They're art objects, mm-hmm. right? But they're not art. Mm-hmm. So this makes some people angry.
Because they were created for utility, and exactly. they're in a museum now just for posterity.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, people have said to me like, "Oh, you know, these races that you do, like this is your art," and I find that it doesn't sit great with me.
I think
I think it's a pretentious thing to say.
I agree.
But I think there is something to be said for the storytelling that I do around that, like how I choose to communicate the meaning of those experiences, you know, in a way that, as I explained earlier, could be helpful or beneficial to others. And I think there is an artistic or creative bent to that, although I wouldn't go so far as to call it art.
Well, so I resist a lot of the categorization that everyone wants. You know, I feel like people want to categorize things or compartmentalize them so that they can feel like they understand them and kind of like check that box and then put it aside. You know, so mm-hmm. I've always been interested in actually problematizing things, right? And so, you know, I don't think that something has to be art for it to be interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Or so I think exactly what you're describing is artistic. It's creative and it's important, you know, in and of itself, right? It doesn't have to be something else in order to then be glorified or justified or made more important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's well said.
So can we talk a little bit about your daughter and her interest in art?
Sure. So I have a 16-year-old daughter. Her name is Mathis. She picked up a paintbrush when she was in diapers. And ever since that moment, we've just sort of tried to support that and get out of the way. Like we would let her paint the walls and Julie would buy these gigantic canvases and just a ton of paint and let her just roll around in it and make a gigantic mess. And that's been cool, you know, like to see her go through phases with it. When she was younger, then she got into like dressmaking and apparel. Like she was like sewing her own clothes and that kind of thing. And we had homeschooled her for many years, and then she went to a school around the corner from here called Muse, which is a pretty progressive kind of open floor plan type situation. And a couple of years ago, she came to us and said, "I found this school that I want to go to. It's called Loxa, and here's the paperwork." Like she had done all this research and homework, and it's this large public school that's kind of like, you know, sort of the LA version of what you would imagine the FAME school is. It's like a visual art, theater, dance, music kind of high school for those kind of kids. And she was determined to try to get into the school. Although it's a public school, you have to get it, you have to apply and get in. And she spent the better part of a year creating a portfolio of visual works, which she then had to go and present to a committee, you know, of teachers sitting behind a table and state her case. And she got in, which was amazing. And she really did it like it was all herself. Like we were supporting her, but it wasn't like our idea, it was her mm-hmm. idea. And now she's a sophomore there, and it's been a really cool experience. It's been challenging because we live way out like northwest of Los Angeles. This school is in is east of downtown Los Angeles. And for people that don't understand the geography of LA, it is a, with traffic, it's 2 hours each way. Mm-hmm. It's just too far to do every day, but it's not so far away that it would be a boarding school situation. Mm-hmm. And they don't let you board anyway, it's a day school. So we had to rent an apartment in downtown. And my wife and I take turns staying in this loft downtown so that we can be there for her, because she's too, even though she would prefer to be emancipated, she's like 16 going on 28, she still does need a little parental guidance. So that's hard, and it's required quite a commitment on behalf of like our family and our marriage in order to do that. But a big part of everything that I'm about and the things that I talk about and feel strongly about, like how do you become your most authentic self? How can you be more creatively expressed? Like, you know, how can you have the courage to you know, set aside your fear and go after this thing that you're passionate about? Like, how can I talk about those things if I'm not practicing them in my own home and supporting my child to do the same? So, of course, we're going to rise to the occasion and support her doing this. So we're in our second year, and, you know, she's really taken to it. Her latest thing is black and white film photography. Like, she sort of pivoted from painting into that, and she's just in the dark room all the time, and she fancies herself like a young Larry Clark, like documenting the disaffected youth of Los Angeles, which, as this waspy person that grew up in a very traditional, you know, kind of household with a specific kind of education, it requires, it really is like, I really have to like take a beat, you know, like, cause I see these images and I'm like, holy shit, man.
That means that she was with these people.
That is gnarly. Right? Yeah. Like, what is going on here? Mm-hmm. So, but they're beautiful and they're amazing. So part of me is like, this is incredible. Like, I celebrate every aspect of this. And then there's the parent who's afraid and protective and all of that. So it's this dance of trying to guide this person, this young person who has a conviction about what she wants to express, who's very strong and opinionated and confident. Like, she has all these things that you want a young person to have, especially a young woman. Like, she's not afraid. She doesn't put herself in, she doesn't try to accommodate other people so that they feel more comfortable. Like, all these things that I did when I was growing up, like, she's got a motor. She's like, I want to work. I got stuff to do. Like, she's got a plan, and that's amazing. But she's also Ubering all over Los Angeles and like God knows where with who knows who, you know what I mean? And it's scary. And I can't control that. And I am a control freak. So as a dad, you know, it's a dance of being supportive, but also being, you know, at times the voice of reason to try to help, you know, just be, you know, a little to create a little bit of grounding, I think. And I think if the challenge is like, if you push too hard or you lay down the law too much, then you get the door closes on the open communication, because she's going to go do what she's going to do anyway. But it has been great to see her blossom as this young artist. They did a show every year at it was like a month ago, or actually a couple weeks ago, where they do an art gallery show downtown of like all the students' work. And I went, and it's just like hundreds of kids in this Chinatown gallery that they take over, and parents, and some of the work was insane. Like, I was looking at a couple paintings, I mean, museum quality work, and I'm like, that kid is in ninth grade, you know, like they're doing some really amazing stuff there. And she's got teachers that she really respects, and she really cares about what they think about the work that she's doing. And I don't think that you can ask for more than that in an educational setting.
There's so many things in what you said, from the idea that I believe that the exact teacher that you need shows up exactly in that moment. So testing for you all of these values, right, that you're putting forth, and you know, your own perspective and authenticity, and I also have a 16-year-old daughter.
Uh-huh.
And the balance between, yeah, wanting them to figure out who they are and you know, and I often joke with my daughter who, over time, I've sort of said, oh, you know, bossy mommy, bossy daughter, right? Uh-huh. Like you get yeah. what you raise. And that is an incredible gift to get to see. So of course your daughter would want to live this authentic life. And of course she would push you in those ways because that's what you're showing her. Whether you are 1,000% always able to commit to that, you know, in your mind, that's what you've shown. Mm-hmm. And so that's, she has no other choice, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think the example that we've tried to set is that, you know, Julie and I are always working on some creative project, and our house is very much like we're in, this used to be a yoga room, now it's a podcast studio. Like, it's kind of an open floor plan that operates like a studio. Like, we've created everything that we've created has come out of this place. And you know, doing photo shoots for cookbooks and making short, you know, videos and all kinds of things over the years. So our kids have kind of grown up with that and they're used to it. And we also have a side business. We rent the house out for photo shoots and film productions and things like that. So they're used to like crews taking over the house for a couple of days to shoot a television commercial or something like that. It's just like normal. And two weekends ago, last weekend, Mathis directed her first music video at the house. So there was like 20 kids here and they had a smoke machine and they're doing like a party scene and like all this. And I was like, that's amazing. Like she was like directing and she got all these kids to come here and like do what she wants them to do. Like at 16 directing a video, like that's awesome.
So we were recording in your podcast studio and we were in your house before we came over here. And I noticed that all the walls in your house were blank other than one photograph.
We need some art. We desperately need some new art. We're in the process. Well, here's one thing I will say. We'll finish your thought first.
I was going to ask, you know, if you consciously live with art wall white walls, you know, without art, or... because your space seems very intentional.
Well, how do I answer this? I mean, first of all, Julie is also a painter. So there's been plenty of her work like circulating. There's been art on that walls and we're like swapping it out and like it's always kind of changing. Part of that is because it's kind of like a moving set. Mm-hmm. And we just had a production here recently and we took everything down. But I think also we haven't found the right, like those great pieces. And part of that is because a big part of our story is that we went through many years of just complete financial meltdown. And, you know, we could barely pay our bills. Like the idea of finding art for the wall, like forget, we're trying to pay the trash bill. Like it was really hard for a long time. And it's hard to conceptualize if you've been to our house, because we have an amazing house, and like I live a life, you know, of embarrassing riches, but we were like the poorest people living in a really nice house because we couldn't pay for it. And it's amazing that it didn't get foreclosed on. I don't know how that happened. It's like a you know, the universe conspiring to support us in a mystical, mysterious way. But we're just now, you know, now everything's great and we're, you know, the house needs a lot of repair and things we can finally like pay for. So we're just doing one thing at a time. But, you know, a big future goal is finding the right pieces of art to adorn the walls, because it is a house that lends itself to that kind of display.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk about that over time. But it is something that I noticed. So
yeah.
And the one photograph that's hanging in there, what is that?
The one
So it's like three people in an elevator.
Oh, that's Julie and her brother and her sister-in-law. They had a band for a while. It's in a light box.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there is a painted wood structure.
Oh, Julie did that.
Okay, that's in the bathroom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have some other art pieces too. We have one of the other things that we've done over the years is we have our house kind of operated like a commune for a long time. We would take in wayward whoever's. who would stay here for extended periods of time. And we've had the opportunity to have two artists live with us. Like one went through a divorce and he lived in an Airstream in our yard. His name is Andrew Pasquella. Actually, he did those pieces over there.
Yeah.
He lived with us for like 2 years, I think. And more recently, a wonderful emerging artist called Brian O'Hara, who also was going through a bit of a financial stretch, and we just made a home for him here. And he turned our garage into his studio for a while. He actually just moved out like a month ago. Beautiful artist. I'll show you his work afterwards. Actually, he did this piece.
I was looking at that. He
does this kind of hieroglyph style of art. He's written backwards his whole life, and he creates this language, and he creates these pastiches out of his own personal typeset. It's pretty cool.
That's really cool.
He created a logo for my podcast, and he created the logo and artwork for my wife's new plant-based cheese company. He's beautifully talented and a lovely guy. You should meet him.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
I'd love to. So let me ask you about some of these objects that are on the desk here with us. Some of them are familiar to me because they're like things that I have sitting in my space as well. Some of the rose quartz crystal and Buddha figure. And so, but where do they come from?
Most of these are gifts from guests who know that I have crystals on the desk, so they bring them to me. This Amor Fati coin is from my friend Ryan Holiday, who has written books about the philosophy of the Stoics. So it's a reminder to know that life is short.
I love the Stoics.
This bracelet actually was brought to me by Rebecca Rush, who is a world champion mountain bike racer, who recently, a couple of years ago, rode the entire length of the Ho Chi Minh Trail in an effort to find the place where her father had perished in the Vietnam War. And in so doing, she supported a nonprofit that goes out and finds all the unexploded ordnance that's out in Cambodia and Vietnam, because there's tons of mines everywhere still. And they explode it and they take the detritus of that and they create jewelry out of it. So that's what this is here. And, you know, Buddhas and mala beads and books and things like that. I don't know. Sometimes I have guests that they're like, we're talking, but they're so fidgety and distracted and they're just kind of like going like that the whole time, you know?
So what's your favorite thing to do?
I think my favorite thing to do is, my favorite thing to do is to wake up early on a beautiful, warm, sunny day and go out on a really long trail run by myself. That's probably my favorite thing to do. I really value my solitude, and spending time alone with myself is super important to me.
So when you do that, do you listen to music?
Rarely. Mm-hmm. Either nothing, just the sound of my breath and whatever you can hear environmentally. But if I'm going, like if it's a training run and I'm going to be out for a long time, I'll listen to an audiobook or a podcast generally. I don't often listen to music. Mm-hmm. I try to occupy my mind in something that will broaden me a little bit, I guess.
So do you still work on your sobriety every day?
Yes. I mean, I'm still very much a member of 12 Step, and that's my number one priority. You know, above all, it's like I'm here to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety, and that's how I stay sober. So I go to meetings all the time and, you know, do the step work and all of that, but I'm not at meetings every single day, but I wake up and I have a morning routine that involves, you know, doing a few certain things. And, you know, I call people throughout the day and they call me, and you know, I try to be of service to alcoholics that are still suffering in a non-public way. Mm-hmm. And what I learned, you know, about how to get sober and stay sober, I try to bring into the work that I do. Mm-hmm. So although podcasting is not 12 step, like I try to be of service to others. And the more I can kind of get out of my own way and, let go of what my ego wants and just try to be present and of maximum service to other people, then I'm happier and I stay sober that way. And everyone around me is a little bit happier too, I suppose.
So I also am a big proponent of a morning routine. What is yours?
Well, I'll preface this by saying there are plenty of days where I work, where I wake up full of anxiety and I go right to the laptop and do all those things you're not supposed to do. So right. I'm hardly perfect in this, but you know, I get up, I make a little coffee, I do 20 minutes of meditation, and then I do morning pages, which is a practice out of the artist's way about unleashing creativity. It's something I've been doing ever since I went to rehab, on and off, to help kind of shake loose the unconscious mind and also kind of clear out whatever it is that is non-essential that's occupying my awareness. So I do that journaling, and then I go out and run or go to the pool. I do something physical after that. So I try to keep it basic. Nowadays, like, morning routines are so in vogue, you know, everybody's got their morning routine, and you know, you string together a bunch of these things and you're looking at like 2 hours every day. Right. It's like all these things you got to do before you can just go and live your life.
Yeah. Mine is almost the same as yours, except for I'm not a coffee drinker. I'm a matcha drinker. Mm-hmm. And I make my bed.
That's a good practice.
It's the easiest one of all five of them. I do five things every morning. Well, I don't get all five every morning. So, but if I get three, then I feel...
There you go.
Accomplished. And usually I get all five by the end of the day.
Right. That's good.
Yeah.
You know, I sleep in a tent.
I did not know that.
You didn't know that? Did you see that tent out back there?
I did see that tent. That yellow tent?
The orange one.
Oh, the orange tent.
Yeah. It's something I started doing a couple of years ago. I've struggled with sleep, and the older I get, the more elusive it is. If I'm training really hard, I sleep well, but when I'm not training super hard, I find it very challenging, and I have to do all sorts of things to kind of ensure that I get a restful evening. And I just find that sleeping outside, I just sleep so much better with the cold air. So I get tons of blankets. I get this gravity blanket that's like a weighted blanket, eye mask. Like, I have a whole thing. But sleeping outside is really, I mean, look, we live in Los Angeles. I don't live in Connecticut, you know, so... But it goes down into the high 30s at night, and I just sleep so much more restfully, and I wake up in the morning just feeling much more rested.
And that's where you sleep every night?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you sleep
unless
by
it's
yourself?
Windy? Like, last night, it got crazy windy. I just felt like I was in it, so I had to come inside and sleep inside. But short of the wind, like, I've never come in because it's too cold. I'll only not do it if it's too windy.
And so did you hear my question about whether you sleep by yourself out there?
Yeah, I do sleep by myself. Julie's like, knock yourself out. I mean, it started because everyone thinks it's like a referendum on our marriage. Like, we've been together for a very 20 years. I mean, we have a fantastic relationship and love each other very much, and it's all good. But it began with, she likes the bedroom really warm and I like it freezing cold. And it's always too cold for her and too hot for me, no matter what we do. And we're both not happy with it. And we used to argue about it all the time. And as a joke, one night I was like, I'm going to go sleep on the roof. We have a flat roof. And I just pulled a sleeping bag out and like a twin mattress out there. And I had an amazing night of sleep. And I was like, I'm going to do this. She's like, fine, have fun. But she's not interested, you know? So she can now sleep with the heat turned up, and we have our intimate time, and it's all, you know, that's all intact and everything like that. But it's funny, everyone wants to project like there's some problem.
You know, one of the things I've learned is that the same thing doesn't equal the same thing in a variety of different circumstances, right? Mm. So for me, when my former husband and I started sleeping separately, it was because that was going to be the end of our marriage.
Yeah.
And that has been the case for a lot of my friends, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what it means for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I kind of love the idea of sleeping outside, but I think I don't have that many fears left, honestly, but I do fear wild animals.
Yeah, well, you just because you live in Aspen, know. You know? I don't think you would have to worry about this here.
Really?
And that, I had the tent up on the roof for a while because I was worried about snakes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I zip it all up. It's fine. But that's a rational fear, living where you live, you know?
I mean, I know, yeah, because there are all sorts of tracks in our backyard. And I did see a bunch of elk there last week, so I'm pretty sure that was what was making the tracks.
You don't want to get trampled.
So, no, but actually a guy came over. He was hanging some art in the house, and he was looking at the tracks. And he said that there had been some sightings of a wolverine, and he wanted to know if that maybe was in our backyard.
A wolverine?
Yeah, I needed to Google that because I wasn't even sure what that would look like. But I never sleep outside, even in the summer.
Yeah.
Because I'm afraid of that.
Well, you could open up the windows, though.
Yes, of course.
And let the cold air in.
Yeah.
You know, I just think, you know, I think that people's reactions to it are interesting because I think it's a reflection of something we were talking about earlier, which is the extent to which we live our lives in reaction to social expectations and societal norms. Like this is what you do. You go to school and then you get this job and this is your trajectory and then you're going to make this much money and then you'll buy your second car and all of these things that are kind of pre-dictated that I think really have so much more domain and control over the decisions that we make. We're not aware how powerful they are. So for me to say, I'm going to sleep in a tent in the backyard, like all I'm doing is doing what human beings did historically for millennia, right? But it's like this weird thing where people think I'm this freak, you know? And I understand, I get it. Or they think, look, if you're in a relationship, like you share this bed and if something should happen with that, then, you know, there's a big problem with the relationship, right? And so where does that come from? It just comes from expectations created by those social norms, right? And you know, my wife, who actually shares a lot of qualities that Laura has, like she's incredibly independent. Like she's like, I don't need you around me all the time. Like, go away. Like when I'm with you, I want you to be super present and for that time to be quality time. But I don't need you in my sphere all the time just so I feel like our relationship is secure. So there's an actual, like, I feel like there's a greater trust and bond and kind of security with the relationship because, you know, we're not always together. So we actually have to work on it harder to make sure that we maintain that. But we do it not through just proximity all the time, but by making sure that our interactions are of the highest caliber.
Well, I think that's actually the greater challenge, right? Is being able to show up in the most vulnerable and authentic way in relationship to someone else.
Yeah, and it's hard, you know? It's really hard. And when you've been with somebody for a very long time, it's so easy to be on autopilot and take your foot off the gas and lose sight of the fact that a relationship is a dynamic, living, breathing thing. And if it's deprived of oxygen, it's gonna starve and die.
Yeah, I think it also, what you're talking about is a level of trust, right? Where if you've shared your soul with your partner, then you also trust that that person is going to be kind with what they know.
Yeah, I think that's right. We don't have a perfect marriage, but it's pretty great. Like, I love my wife and, you know, I'm really happy to be with her, so.
I think that the idea of being able to create with the person that you're with is something that adds to longevity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think it's a complexifier also. Mm-hmm. You know, Julie and I, we do collaborate. We have things that we do independent of each other. Like, this is my show and she has a plant-based cheese company now and she does a lot. I mean, she's, you know, always doing a million things. Whereas I like to pick a lane and be very focused on one thing. Like, we're very different in that regard, but there's something about when we come together where we are able to create something that has, you know, kind of exponentially more value and depth. But that also, you know, there's a tax that you pay with that because it does require you then to create boundaries around what's professional and what is, you know, relationship. So you have to be understand, like, because it just everything bleeds together, right? So you can just be constantly talking about work. So you have to be a little bit more mindful of making sure that you're tending to the relationship. And because we're very different, like we'll have different opinions about a way, you know, a certain way something should go. And that can descend into argument, or it provides an opportunity to work on our communication skills.
What do you think is the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Just like hammering me with the philosophical hard questions. How dare you? Supposed to come up with some nugget of wisdom here.
I think you're wise.
Ask me again. The hardest question, what?
Mm-mm. Yeah, that's
The hardest.
That's how you heard it.
Yeah, I'm buying time. This is a tactic.
The question is the best piece of advice you've ever been given.
Mm-hmm. You should really stop drinking. I say that in jest. I mean, probably is the best mm-hmm. advice I've ever been given. But I think in a more philosophical way, you know, the best piece of advice that I've been given that has required the most amount of faith on my part is something Julie said to me, and it's something I put in my book, which is, when your heart is true, the universe will conspire to support you. Not on your timeline.
Right.
Not the way you think it should work out. Mm-hmm. But I truly believe that if you can find that song within you that is yearning to be sung, and out of purity of heart, you usher up the courage to manifest that in the world, that I think the universe shows up to support you in magical and mysterious ways you could never predict. And I think that's part of the beauty of living a creative life that I think a lot of people miss out on out of fear or out of that social programming.
Yeah, I've talked a few times on my podcast about a really transformative trip that I took to Thailand last November. And when you meditate with the monks there, try and grant you your wish, right? You can basically like make a wish before you meditate and then they'll bless you. Mm-hmm. And what they also say is, you know, what you wished for or something better.
Yeah. Because we're our own biggest self-limiters.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other thing, you know, you said it's not necessarily on your timeline, but what they add is right now. And that was my favorite part of it, was that they would say, you know, what you wish for or something better right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of immediacy somehow, I think, shakes things loose.
Yeah, I think that's important. But I also think a critical piece is to orient your life around the work itself, whatever it is that you're trying to express, and make it about that. Like, find the joy and the love of that, and do everything in your power to divorce yourself from the results.
Exactly.
And the more you can let go of being results driven, I think you will find happiness, and I think you'll find a deeper reservoir of creativity and expression.
Yeah. That they also say that, you know, you don't have to wait for the thing that you want to have happen to be happy. You get to be happy on your way there.
That choice is always available to you.
Yeah.
As elusive as it is.
So, last question. Why do you think art matters?
What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to coexist on this mortal coil if we can't find ways of communicating and conveying higher truths through various means? Like, to me, I look at art. Art is a way of taking something specific and making it universal, right? And we have ways in which we do that through the written word and through journalism or whatever. But to really get at the core, the deepest, most profound, shared, universal experiences, we need a multitude of different manners of expression to do that. And I think that is what enriches our lives and gives us a sense of universal truth, universal shared truth, and beauty.
Well, beauty goes right to my heart every single time. But I love that notion of taking something that is specific and making it universal. And that's actually how I think we start to understand that we have more in common than we think we do.
Yeah. And we could all use a little bit more of that right now, I think.
Hopefully that's the path forward. Mm-hmm. Thanks for talking to me today.
Thank you so much.
I loved it.
This was really fun.
I thought so too.
Conversations About Art is part of HiZ.art. Simon Illa is our producer. Our theme music was composed by Eric McDougall. Jordan Weisberg is our curatorial associate. Robert Zinda documented this conversation. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and review us on whichever platform you listened, as it helps us further our goal of connecting all to art. We will be back again every other Tuesday with new episodes. Thanks for listening.